This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When America was attacked 16 years ago today, brave first responders came to Ground Zero to rescue people buried in the rubble and to retrieve the remains of those no longer alive. My guest John Feel got there on September 12th. 5 days later, he was supervising a crew at Ground Zero when an 8,000-pound piece of steel fell on his foot, crushing it. He barely survived the gangrene and subsequent infections and lost half his foot. He was unable to return to work. His despair grew deeper when he was informed he wasn't eligible for financial aid to cover his huge medical bills. After finding that many other first responders were suffering from physical injuries and illnesses caused by the toxins at Ground Zero but had no financial support to pay their health care bills, Feel became an activist. He formed the Feel Good Foundation and began working to pressure Congress to pass a bill that would provide compensation for medical care and monitoring. He made nearly 80 trips to Capitol Hill, sometimes taking with him busloads of other first responders who walked the halls of Congress and met with almost every representative and senator. In December of 2010, the James Zadroga 9/11 Health and Compensation Act was passed. A month later, the bill's co-sponsor, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, took Feel to the State of the Union address, saying he embodied the spirit of 9/11 workers. After the bill was implemented, Feel started lobbying again, this time for reauthorization of the bill, which was set to expire in 5 years. That reauthorization was passed in 2015 and will provide medical funding until 2090. John Feel, welcome to Fresh Air. How did you end up working at Ground Zero?
Well, one, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. My honor. Thank you for the work you've been doing.
Especially on this anniversary. When 9/11 happened, I was about a half an hour outside of New York City in Nanuet doing a large demolition job. And later that night, we started packing heavy machinery and the tools and the equipment needed to go down there and assist. And got there on the 12th, and I was in the Army. I seen some pretty bad things, but I never saw that kind of destruction, devastation, carnage. I was awed. And I saw, people always ask me what I'll take from that. Those 5.5 days that I was there before I was horribly injured is the grown men, macho, burly, guys with mustaches the size of poodles and tattoos, crying and hugging each other. And I kind of felt out of place. I felt like a little kid. And I did whatever was needed of me to work those 5.5 days. And
What was your job?
I was a supervisor in a demolition company. And at Ground Zero, I was one of those put in charge to delegate orders from the top to the bottom for the cleanup at Building 7.
So where were you physically?
During those 5.5 days, I was pretty much all over the 13 acres of Ground Zero, whether it was moving machinery or making sure that they had manpower to go from one place to another.
So describe the accident. Describe what happened to you.
My injury at the time, horrific, gruesome, pales in comparison to those who are sick and dying. And I'll always take a back seat to those with these deadly illnesses. Roughly 8,000 pounds of steel crushed my left foot.
So from where? Like, did it fall? What did it fall from?
So we were loading about 250 trucks with steel every 12 hours. And we were pulling out a piece of steel. And depending on the size of the truck, that steel had to be cut to the size of the truck. And one of the pieces of steel were being torched, and it fell over. And I jumped out of the way because if I didn't, it probably would have crushed me, or the truck that was backing up would have just crushed me into the steel that already crushed me. So I jumped, and I didn't get all the way out of the way. It caught my left foot. The guy next to me fainted because the blood was shooting out of my foot about 6 feet in the air. I made a tourniquet because I took his belt off, and I made a tourniquet below my knee. Fire department was there within 3 minutes. And then I had a four-car police escort to Bellevue, because the ambulance that took me to Bellevue was from Michigan. And that just shows you the amount of people that came from all over the country to help during the cleanup and the recovery.
So the guy next to you, just seeing what happened to you, he fainted.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Whereas you had the presence of mind to take his belt, make a tourniquet out of it.
Yeah.
How did you have the presence of mind to do that? How were you even able to remain conscious after a shock to the system like that? You said like blood was shooting up like 6 feet in the air.
Well, I I was 120 over 80. They call it coherent shock, and that's a term I've never even heard before. But I had first aid training. I was in the Army. I coached wrestling. You know, before 9/11, in my mind, I was the world's greatest athlete, and I was John Wayne. I was that cool. I didn't think I could even be hurt. And that was a rude awakening for me physically and mentally. But I was able to get to safety, take my boot off where the bones were sticking out of my sock. And I don't want to gross anybody out. But I tried to get my sock off, and I was taking my razor blade knife, and by that time the fire department was there, and they put a towel in front of me, and I knew, you know, I was yelling at everybody, get back to work, I'll be back in an hour, you know. it was a very humbling experience, and at the time, it was devastating, it altered my life, and I thought it was for the worst, but I look back now, and it gives me a chance to show everybody how my mother raised me, so I'm thankful.
So, you know, your foot was incredibly damaged. Like, what was the extent of the damage to your foot? It sounds like every bone in your foot must have been broken.
Yeah, so I spent 9 days in Bellevue where I developed gangrene. And they put 6-inch pins through my toes. You're not supposed to pin a crushed injury, little did I know, because I don't have a medical degree. And doctor said I had gangrene. And then I was transferred to North Shore University in Plainview, where I fought for my life. I became septic. And little by little, I fought it, but I wound up losing half of my left foot. And that was my consolation, and I consider that a victory. And you will never, ever hear me complain. I've had about 39, 40 surgeries since then on my feet, my knees. I'm arthritic in both hips from the way I walk. I have a spinal stenosis from the neck to the spine with a permanent broken back from the way I walk. I even donated a kidney to a complete stranger, so never feel sorry for me. But after I got out of the hospital, after 11 weeks in the hospital, going from 185 pounds to about 120, I knew not only was there something physically wrong with me, there was something mentally wrong with me. And I'm not embarrassed to admit it. After being diagnosed by doctors with post-traumatic, I did EMDR for 2 years. I went to really strict, hardcore counseling and therapy, and if I didn't do it, I probably wouldn't be here talking to you today.
What were your symptoms of PTSD?
Depression, mood swings, anger, crying, laughing, feeling lost, confused, not wanting to be with anybody, no friends, no family. You know, I spent 11 weeks in the hospital. Nobody was allowed in my hospital room except for my mother and my sister. Not even my other family members and my closest friends were allowed in there.
Wait, because you didn't want them or because the doctor said no one was allowed?
Because I didn't want them. I was embarrassed, you know. Again, before 9/11, you know, I was captain of the wrestling team. I was the best player on any team, any sport I ever played. And it really humbled me. And it made me realize that I will never be the same person as I was. But I look back now, and I'm not physically gifted like I am or was, but I'm so much better of a person. I'm more giving, I'm more caring, I'm more understanding. And it's easier for me to make conscious choices now where I know it's going to benefit people.
It sounds like you have a lot of chronic pain as a result of all of the injuries, in addition to the main injury, your foot. Now you have an injured back, you have stenosis, you have knee problems.
Imagine walking on broken glass barefoot with 800 pounds on your shoulders. That's my day. And I don't take medication. I refuse to put any pills in my body. And not only just because I donated a kidney. I just don't ever want to be drugged down. I'd rather be in pain. Physically and mentally, I'd rather be in pain. Because it's my energy. It's what I channel towards positive energy. And this is not for everybody. And I'm not saying it works for that person. It works for me. And it gives me my edge.
Are you able to sleep at night?
I sleep better now than when I used to. But, you know, this time of the year, this anniversary, you know, a few days before 9/11, today, after this, you know, it's tough, not just for me, it's tough for all 9/11 responders and volunteers and survivors and people who lived and worked down in Ground Zero. You know, they call these scars. They're not scars, they're scabs. And these scabs get pulled right off around this time of the year. And it's tough. You know, when I was going to therapy back in 2002 and 3 and 4 and 5, I had the same reoccurring nightmares. And again, if I didn't do this, if I didn't do that therapy, and I implore anybody who suffers from PTSD, not just from 9/11, but in life in general, from a traumatic accident or military veterans, get help. It truly helps. And there are people that are really well trained at that.
Were the nightmares you were having reliving 9/11, or are they other stories that were coming out in your nightmares?
Well, the same. It's the same. It was the same recurring dream where I would see the plane crash, and I would, you know, one day I'd be sitting on a park bench with my dog, plane be driving by, and I couldn't do anything. Then it was personal, and it was like the next day I was sitting on the park bench with my dog, and I would see my mother in the window of the plane waving, you know. And then little by little, after doing therapy, I was able to get off the park bench and get up and like Superman, stop the plane from crashing into the building.
So you've told us a little bit about the medical problems you had, the extensive surgeries, many surgeries. Did you have the money to pay for it? Did your health insurance cover it?
Well, so the non-uniform worker, which outnumbered the uniform worker 4-1 on ground at 9/11 in the days and weeks and months that followed, most of us who lost our jobs lost our insurance. But that's why we have workman's comp and Social Security disability. I was denied those. So half of my foot's in a jar.
Wait. Let's stop right there. Why were you denied those?
I'm actually telling you like I'm asking you because I was dumbfounded at the time. And that's the reason why I started the Feel Good Foundation. That's the reason why I'm here today talking to you. Because I was a reaction to their lack of action. Being denied created the advocate, John Feel. And I look back now, everything that happened to me that's happening to people now, it's easier for me to help them. But I was denied.
Why?
You know, because I worked for one company and I was subbed out to another company who was subbed me out to another company at Ground Zero. So when I got hurt, all three of them went to court to see who wasn't going to pay me, you know. I found it comical because they all said they were my friends and that they cared. But 90% of all 9/11 responders who apply for these benefits get denied. It's 90% who appeal win. A lot of them have the physical and mental energy to follow through. But now the Feel Good Foundation's there to navigate through them, has contacts with all of the congressional and senatorial offices where we can help navigate and ease their pain.
How did you become an activist? I mean, you'd become a little withdrawn as a result of the shock and the PTSD. You didn't want to be around people for a while, but then you became an activist, being very much in touch with a lot of other first responders, lobbying. I think you met like every member of Congress while you were lobbying for a first responders bill. So what was behind that change?
Well, one, I'm an introvert trained to be an extrovert, and I tell that to everybody I meet, and they're like, no, it's not. And I am a loner. And I choose to live my life that way. And unless I'm doing an interview or going to a 9/11 event or I go to the gym in the morning or walk my dog, I don't really leave my house. And alone time helps me recharge my batteries. But, you know, when I was not only going for individual counseling right after 9/11, after getting out of the hospital and therapy, I started going to support groups. And I started meeting other 9/11 responders. And while I was only one of a few physical injuries and being the worst, there were those who had illnesses that were invisible. But they were losing their homes. They were getting divorced or separated, or the kids were in rehab for drugs because daddy or mommy were miserable. And then, you know, the old saying, and I hate the cliche, is there's always somebody worse off than you. And then I was telling people about my experience on workman's comp or Social Security. And I started helping them. And I started going to their hearings. And then the next thing you know it, I started taking other 9/11 responders to somebody else's hearings. And then the judges and the lawyers were like, oh, here comes Field with his crew. And I looked back and it was primitive, but it was effective. And again, at the end of the day, I don't apologize or second guess myself, because we're talking about human life. We're talking about human beings who are trying to put food on the table for their kids or pay their utilities or put gas in their car to get to a chemotherapy appointment. So it didn't matter what elected official or what lawyer or what judge or what doctor I pissed off, because the only thing I care about at the end of the day is helping people.
So you had trouble getting compensated for your medical expenses, and your expenses must have been huge. Do you have a number for how much money you owed?
Hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah,
in medical debt.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so there was a cutoff point. And initially, there was money set aside for first responders, but I think it was only first responders who were injured within 96 hours of the
Correct.
Attack, and you were injured 120 hours later.
Yeah.
So because of that extra, 24 hours, you were ineligible. What was the logic behind that cutoff point?
You know, at that time, it was devastating because I thought I qualified, and I was turned away. And again, it's another roadblock and obstacle and hurdle that I overcame. They said 96 hours was the cutoff, but how can somebody get sick from 9/11? How do they know it was 96 hours before that? Because these illnesses are invisible. I had a physical injury. All I had to do was take off my shoe and show them. But it was at that time, it was insult to injury, another blow to my ego, another defeat. But I was never out, you know. And while I continued to take one on the chin for the team, I became more resilient. And the more I was denied personally or see other people get denied, it just fed my energy.
So you were one of the activists who lobbied for what's known as the Zadroga Act, which was passed in 2010, signed in 2011, to cover medical expenses for first responders. What was your approach in Congress to talking to the men and the women there who were resistant, trying to convince them that first responders really needed this bill and was just like ethically wrong, morally wrong not to pass it?
Well, others will call what I did guerrilla lobbying. I consider it educating our nation's leaders. But in the beginning, it was hard. Listen, take 9/11 out of the equation. A Republican or a Democrat from the middle of the country or on the West Coast hate New Yorkers. They think New York gets everything and not blah, blah, blah. But it was tough getting a Republican from Texas or Montana to get on board with the Zadroga bill in 2010. And listen, we got lucky. We, with the help of John Stewart, John asked me to come on his show. I said no. I gave him four 9/11 responders, and that was a huge hit. Following day, Shep Smith from Fox News followed up what John Stewart did. Next thing you know it, the 24-hour news cycle is now putting pressure on Republican leadership. So it was a domino effect, but that's how we got it done in 2010.
How did John Stewart get in touch with you? Do you know why?
Well, yeah. His producer called me. He's like, Mr. Field, Mr. Stewart would like to talk to you. I said, okay. He's like, John Field, this is John Stewart. And he was eating a sandwich. And he's like, check this out. You're going to come on my show. We're going to embarrass Republicans. We're going to get the bill passed. And I said, sir, I am humbled. If I ever write a book, I'd love to come on your show, but I can't. He said, what do you mean you can't come on my show? I said, well, I got to finish what I started. I'll be in D.C. tomorrow. Because I like that, a man of integrity. But give me four guys, we'll put them on the show, we'll embarrass Republicans, we'll get the bill passed. Exactly. He didn't miss a beat. And I vetted four guys, put them on the show, and John dedicated that whole show to them. And ever since then, I've become close friends. I actually texted John this morning for him to listen to this, and he's listening. So to somebody with his stature and his resources, to make himself available to the 9/11 community, I'm forever grateful and humbled.
In 2015, when you were seeking reauthorization for the bill because it was expiring, John Stewart was back with you. In fact, he went with you to Congress and knocked on the doors of several congressmen and women with cameras, asking mm-hmm. to be interviewed. And I think the goal was both to pressure and to embarrass. So what was that experience like for you? And what was the reaction you got from the aides, from the congressional aides, when you were there with Jon Stewart compared to the reaction you'd get when you were there just by yourself and with other fellow 9/11 responders?
Well, you know, John definitely, again, shined light on our issue. You know, just so you know, I had anywhere from 5, 10, 15, sometimes 40 guys with me in D.C. Everybody got a nickname because I could never remember everybody's name. John wanted to be part of the team when he was embedded with us. And John's first words were, Phil, give me a nickname. Give me a nickname. And I said, your nickname is Colbert. And then he kicked me in the shin. But John went into those meetings with us. And the first couple meetings, he watched how we did it. And by the 8th and 9th or 12th meeting of the day, he got it. And he was, he's a take charge type of guy. And he's a fast learner. But John saw the pain and suffering that we were going through. But what separates 2015 from 2010, we had statistics. We had facts. I would take people from a state and have them come to D.C. and show that member of Congress or go into their home office. You know, 433 out of 435 congressional districts were represented at Ground Zero. There's over 78,000 people now in the country that are in the World Trade Center Health Program, in the national program. So the holdup in 2015 was Republican leadership playing games because Mitch McConnell. And we had a meeting with Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, McConnell wouldn't bring the bill to the floor. If even though there was a majority that would support it.
We had 70 co-sponsors. We had a two-thirds majority in the House and the Senate. How do you get 70 co-sponsors in the Senate and over 300 and something in the House and have a bill sitting there and dying and then finally getting attached to the omnibus at the end of the year? It was insulting.
So your lobbying was very effective in getting the first responders' health funding extended in 2015. And now the reauthorization of the bill extends those benefits to 2090. So what's the next step for you?
Well, I mean, right now we're still advocating and petitioning the Scientific Technical Advisory Committee to get more illnesses added to the bill. Neuropathy, autoimmune, cardiovascular. These are illnesses that we feel need to be added to the bill. But then again, in 3 years, 2.5 years, we will be back in D.C. Fighting a new member of Congress and the Senate to get the bill extended for the VCF. You know, most people think on this anniversary that two buildings came down that day and 2,753 innocent lives were lost, 343 firefighters, 23 police officers, 37 Port Authority officers. Everybody just thinks these men and women died, and they did, and they died because of senseless violence. But since then, about 2,000 people have died because of their illnesses. They, too, are heroes. And in many ways, I talk to a lot of them, they wish they would have died that day. Because what they've had to go through and fight, not only their illnesses, but the bureaucracy and the poor leadership, and to see their other friends pass away from 9/11-related illnesses, these men and women have been through the ringer, through the mill. And, you know, I'm disheartened sometimes because in my mind, I'm the most patriotic person I know. And we call ourselves the greatest nation in the world, but yet we have a strange way of repeating history and letting veterans come home from war or 9/11 responders or just responders now across the nation, how they sacrifice themselves and then we don't take care of them. That's sad.
In spite of the fact that your body was so injured after the 8,000-pound piece of steel fell on your foot, you donated a kidney to another first responder.
Well, originally supposed to go to a first responder, it wound up going to a woman in Connecticut.
Oh, yeah, because it was a swap. So, like, take us back to the beginning of the story. Yeah. How did you decide to try to donate a kidney to a first responder?
Well, you know, I had no intention of donating my kidney. There was a man named Paul who went to my website and emailed me. And he's like, can you put my story on your website? I said, no. If I did that for you, I'd have to do it for everybody. And then it really drowns out or muddles down my mission statement. But what I will do is if I'm a match, I'll give you my kidney. He replied back with some curse words. How can you be so cold and callous? I said, no, dude, you can have my kidney. So after a couple of days of talking on the phone and exchanging emails, we made an appointment at Columbian Presbyterian. We took a test a couple of weeks later. I was compatible, but I wasn't 100% match. I was ready to donate a kidney. He was not ready to receive. A few months went by, and the hospital was like, John, if you give your kidney to somebody else, we'll ensure Paul gets a better one. I said, okay, great. I get to help two people. Paul didn't want anybody else's kidney but mine, so the hospital made me talk to him. And I said, Paul, my kidney's not going to make you walk on water. You know, go and get that better kidney, because if you reject mine, I'm going to be mad at myself for my kidney not working. A couple months go by, and the hospital's like, well, John Hopkins has done it a couple of times. We'd like to do it here. We want to do a six-person swap. So I was like, so I get to help three people, you know, because in essence, without me, those other three people don't get a kidney. So they're like, yeah. I said, well, sign me up, because this is really cool. And, you know, I never won Lotto. I'll never be filthy rich. But giving the gift of life to one person directly and the other two indirectly, there's not a better feeling in the world knowing that person wakes up every morning with a part of me in them.
So the way the swap worked, like you donated your kidney in return for three people being moved up to the top of the list to get kidneys? Is that the way it worked?
Yeah. So they took three recipients and three donors, six hospital rooms all simultaneously in a row. And they removed three and inserted three. And it was about a month later where I got to meet everybody.
Yeah. So did everybody survive?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Paul actually died last year of a stroke. But he made it nine years.
That's a long time.
So last week was my 10-year anniversary of that.
Huh. What did you do to commemorate the anniversary of giving up a kidney?
I Facebook timed with Tracy from Connecticut.
She's
young
the person
woman
who has your kidney.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be part of that and to know that my kidney's in her, again, I think those who have donated a kidney that are listening to this know that feeling of euphoria, whatever you call it. It's just a special feeling.
So one of the things you've done was to create a wall with the names of first responders who have subsequently died to memorialize them. What gave you the idea for the wall, and where is it?
Well, thank you for bringing that up, because that park where that wall is my baby. It's on Long Island in Wisconsin. And about a decade ago, I was approached by local town officials to build a 9/11 memorial after an intersection had reconstructed. And there was an open, empty 1 acre of land. And they said, would you like to get involved? And when I went to this meeting, everybody's like, yeah, let's do this. And I said, you know, rightfully so, there's 9/11 memorials all over the country. And you'll never hear me complain about that. But there's no 9/11 memorial for those who continue to die from 9/11. And everybody looked at me like I was crazy. But I said, if you want me to get involved, that's what I wish. And I got my way. And now on 1 acre of land, the 9/11 Responders Remembered Park has a 60-foot granite wall. It's got about 800 names on there. On September 16th, 5 days from now, we're going to add 164 names. And it's got a 17-foot high clock. It's got a gazebo. It's got statues. It's got a piece of steel in there. It's got a time capsule to be opened in like 2038 or something. But it's my baby. I live 3 minutes from there. I take my dog there twice a day. We pick up the garbage if there's garbage. But it respects and honors and remembers those who died that day and those who continue to die.
So how many funerals for first responders have you gone to?
171. And I paid for about 8 or 9 of them.
So it sounds like you definitely keep count of how many you've been to.
Yeah. Well, I have those mass cards.
Sure.
On top of, I save those. Mm-hmm. And they're on top of my desk. And it's my motivation. And it makes sure that it enables me to continue to do the work I do and make sure that I don't complain about the petty stuff. You know, I've seen, you know, Greg Quibel passed away from AML leukemia. And I was in the hospital room when he passed away with his family, and Greg held my hand. And I was like, wow, that's weird. He could be holding his wife's hand or his kid's hands. And his last words were, John, make sure my family's taken care of. And he passed away. I had a dying man hold my hand when he died. That's a lot of pressure. That's a lot of strain.
So having been to 171 funerals, and I'm sure you will be to more, sadly, how has it affected your thoughts about death and what death is and whether you're afraid of it or not?
Great question. Great question. I think when we die, we die. I think we're energy. I think we go into the ground and we just keep the food chain going. And I'm not so much into all of that biblical religious stuff, but I do believe there's a God. I believe we're here for a purpose. And I believe when we leave, there's also a purpose. And I think our energy goes to other people and our energy continues. I'm not afraid of dying. No. Sometimes I, hey, listen, just because I went to therapy when I wanted to kill myself after getting out of the hospital, those thoughts creep up. I do have my bad days. Would I do it? No. Am I strong enough to stop myself? Yes. But I am not afraid to die. And there are times when I wish I would have died instead of a friend or somebody who left behind four kids. And I begged God, my God, to take me instead of them.
When you say that you wanted to kill yourself after you got out of the hospital, did you come close to actually doing it?
The fact that I was, it was consuming my daily thought process, yeah, I was close. Did I put a gun to my mouth? No. Did I put a razor blade to my wrist? No. Did I swallow 100 pills? No. Did I have access to all three? Yes. I'm still here. And, you know, I spent 11 weeks in the hospital laying on my back. Physically, I deteriorated. Mentally, I deteriorated. And I don't judge anybody if that's what they would have went through. I know people that killed themselves for less. So
what stopped you?
My mother. Now, my mother passed away in 2006. My mother was my father, my mother, my best friend. She was my everything. And that's not saying I was a mama's boy, but my mother's smarter now, dead, than when she was alive, because everything she ever told me has come true. But my mother raised me a certain way, and it's not to be better than anybody, but to be different.
So when she was there for you during that really dark period, what did she do that helped you through it?
Well, she had cancer, and she wanted to live, and she was fighting, and I was feeling sorry for myself. And, you know, my mother never complained. My mother never once complained. And, you know, she smoked her whole life. I don't smoke. And she was okay. And she just wanted her kids to be happy and make sure that everybody was okay. And I saw her suffer for 2.5 years and never once say, John, why me? Or, oh, John, this hurts. I can't take this. And, you know, if my mother can live like that, then I can.
Do you ever think back about the moment of impact when the steel beam crest your foot? And I know I've asked you to tell us the story. I'm sure I'm one of many journalists who have asked you to tell that story, one of many other people who have asked you to tell that story. But when you're alone, does your mind go back to that moment, or do you try to protect yourself from reliving it?
No. I'm doing it as we speak. I can block out my injury. I can block out my 5 days there. I can't block out the smell. Probably why I don't sleep enough. When I close my eyes, I could smell Ground Zero. And everybody always asks, what would it smell like? And it's just, there's not a word invented yet that describes the smell of Ground Zero. But going back to the impact of that steel beam hitting my foot, it's vivid. I can feel it when it hits me. But if that never happened, where would I be today?
Where do you think you'd
would
be?
They have got, well, I'd probably still be working. I'd probably have 2 feet. I probably wouldn't have had so many surgeries. And who knows what I'd be doing.
Mm-hmm.
But would the Sajoga bill got passed? Maybe. Would all those other bills have gotten passed? Maybe. Would that person have gotten a kidney? Maybe. I think everything happens for a reason. And would I like to have my other half of my foot back? Absolutely.
Why do you think it's the smell that haunts you most about the pit after 9/11?
Because it's a smell that I've never smelled before or after. It's a smell of the... It was the smell of destruction, devastation, carnage. It was everything combined in one that just created the smell. And this is not just me saying this. This is other 9/11 responders and first responders and volunteers who will say the same thing. Especially this time of the year when I shut my eyes, that smell comes back, and it's like it's putting its hand over my mouth and nose, and it gets tough. It gets tough. I'm opening it up now and telling you this because you never see me post this on Facebook or say it like this, because I'm always giving that motivational pep talk and telling people, you know, chin up, chest out, drive on, you know, be the same person you were on 9/11. You're a hero. But, you know, we're all human. We all have our flaws. And I'm flawed. I'm flawed. And I believe every person who ever existed is flawed. And some of us just don't open up and talk about it, you know? You know, when somebody comes to me for help through the Feel Good Foundation, depending on what they need, there's a good chance I went through what they're already going through. And it's easy to associate with them and connect with them because I know what it is to suffer, not only physically and mentally and financially, but I have suffered. And it's not a good feeling. The feeling is when you're down, and there's one knee on the ground, you're going to get back up. And that's where you measure yourself.
So one more question for you. Has working with 9/11 responders, many of whom have died since you first met them, advocating on their behalf, changed the nature of friendship for you? My impression of you as a loner is that maybe you weren't the most, you know, like emotionally communicative guy in the world.
Yeah.
But... I suspect that you became more emotionally accessible and communicative since doing this work.
Well, you're psychoanalyzing me, and you're spot on. You know, I grew up in a household where my father was abusive, an alcoholic. I was the youngest of five. I was shielded and protected by my mother. But it wasn't okay to cry in my house. I had to be tough. You know, from the age of five until my early 20s, I was doing judo and wrestling. But I had to be tough, and I didn't know what it was to not be tough. But now my small circle of friends, and it's small, and they are 9/11 responders, but they're mixed in with my childhood friends. They get to see that sensitive, softer side of me. They get to see me cry. They get to see me be jovial. You know, the way I'm talking to you now is the way I acted and reacted when we got the bill passed twice in Congress. It takes a lot to get me to come out of character. The only time I really ever come out of character is if somebody has the ability to help somebody and doesn't do it for a reason that doesn't measure up to my standards. That's when I tend to come out of character. I just don't understand how human beings can be so cold and callous and hurt each other. It will never register with me.
Well, thank you for mentioning that you had, you know, an abusive father. It helps me understand how difficult it must have been for you to feel vulnerable after a profound injury like the one that you had.
Well, yeah, you know, because after I got hurt, and even in therapy, while I didn't really ever get along with my father after the age of 16, I was 34 when I got hurt, and I still felt like I let my father down in so many ways. And, you know, my father was a lot of things that I'm not proud of or happy about him, but he was a hard worker, and he instilled hard work in me. And I felt like I let my father down. That was part of me going to therapy. And I was in the hospital for 11 weeks, and while I was medicated, they said my father was there once, and I don't remember.
Is he alive
and
now?
My father... No, he passed away a couple years ago, and you know, I never got to say, "Dad, I wanted to punch you in the face for what you did to my mother and your kids, but I forgive you, and I hope you're okay with your life." And you know, I never got to say those things, But I got to say everything I had to say to my mother, mm-hmm. and that means more to me. But, you know, you can have 100 fathers, you're only going to have one mother. And I miss her dearly. You know, I go through my life every day missing somebody. And I think we all do. I'm no different than anybody else. But we're human beings, and we're programmed to move forward. But moving forward, I want to live my life honoring them and trying to be a better person tomorrow for them. You know, walking over here this morning, I saw a homeless person at your down the street, maybe four or five buildings down, and I gave her a $5 bill. It's probably not the right thing to do because I'm enabling them, but people are suffering. And I think everybody's got so much on their plate. If everybody just stopped and looked around and said, how can I make this country better? How can I make this world better? I think you'd see a big difference, but nobody wants to stop. You know the old saying, and it's usually passed down through generational advice from an older person, say you only live once. I don't buy that. You only die once, you live every day. And I'm going to live my life.
That's good. That's good.
You know, but yeah. I want to live my life every day, and I want to live my life knowing that when I go to bed, I made a difference. You know, every morning when I go to 7-Eleven with my dog who has to go for a ride and has to go to 7-Eleven, whoever's in back of me online, I buy their coffee for them. And they're all in shock. Why are you doing that? Because you're going to do something good for somebody during the course of the day. It's contagious. It's contagious.
That's really nice. Well, John Field, thank you so much for talking with us today, for helping us remember 9/11. And thank you so much for the work that you did after 9/11 and the work you've subsequently done helping first responders. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. And on a day like this, I hope we all find comfort in knowing that as a nation, we can mourn together and move forward and help those who still need help.
John Feel was a 9/11 first responder and is the founder of the Feel Good Foundation, whose mission is to assist emergency personnel. Tomorrow on Fresh Air.
There's something happening. They're not reporting it. Katie, you're not reporting it, Katie.
My guest will be Katie Turr, who covered the Trump campaign for NBC and MSNBC and was called out by Trump several times at rallies, which led to jeers and threats. She's written a new memoir. I hope you'll join us.